It is an article of faith for liberal thought. Let truth and falsehood grapple, and truth will eventually prevail. We do not control speech nor writing, trusting that false and true, good and bad ideas will all be debated and that the best will eventually emerge. For John Milton, arguing for a relatively free press, the debate of all ideas was essential, morally, politically, spiritually. I say he was arguing for a relatively free press because his tolerance did not extend to popery, Roman Catholicism, nor to open superstition, whatever he meant by that. Sticks and stones may break my bones, we say, and we legislate against those strongly, but words will never hurt me. Legally, and in places where lively debate is important, such as schools and colleges and, one hopes, churches, we have traditionally drawn a bright line between the harm done by actions and the discomfort and hurt feelings caused by words. In short, we are very much descendants of Milton. Now, his thinking was not so naive as to believe that all would come true, all would be done in the right way quickly. He believed that we must not protect people from immoral ideas because the struggle to determine right from wrong is actually necessary for the development of virtue. If the human heart is a battlefield between good and evil, and for Milton, writing in England in 1644, it assuredly was, the true warfaring Christian is, quote, he that can apprehend and consider vice with all her baits and seeming pleasures, and yet abstain, and yet distinguish, and yet prefer that which is truly better. Fast forward 3 centuries, and James Luther Adams is saying much the same thing. Last week, we heard about the first of his 5 smooth stones of liberal religion, his guiding principles for a free faith. The second major principle of religious liberalism, he writes, is that all relations between persons ought ideally to rest on mutual free consent and not coercion. Fair enough. Furthermore, he goes on to say that this expresses itself in our religious seeking. All persons by nature potentially share in the deepest meanings of existence. All have the capacity for discovering or responding to saving truth, and all are responsible for selecting and putting into action the right means and ends of cooperation for the fulfillment of human destiny. In turn, he writes, the method of free inquiry is the necessary condition for the fullest apprehension of either truth or justice, and also for the preservation of human dignity. The method of free inquiry and persuasion is the only one consistent with both the dignity and the limitations of human nature. And he goes on to say, and again, he is following in Milton's footsteps, not only do we have the hope that the best will win out in time, but it is the only way for us to proceed toward the justice and the truth that we seek. Because what would we do? Abolish some falsehoods from being spoken? Perhaps today's falsehoods are tomorrow's truths. We need only look backwards a few years in our history to see how quickly one falsehood becomes known as truth through the open exchange of ideas. For Adams, the conviction goes back to the bedrock theological assertion of religious liberalism that, quote, all are children of one God. We are one. Our equality is an inescapable result of our creation. So goes liberalism. And then, in recent years, and perhaps intensified with the intensified political strife of the last few years, but going farther back than that, there's been a challenge to this liberal idea. A deep fear of the limit about the limitations of the open debate of ideas, the complete freedom that is proposed by the likes of Milton and Adams. Whoever knew truth put to the worse, we might ask Milton, well, all you have to do is open the newspaper to see a dozen examples of truth losing to falsehood. As some might say, the falsehood can get three times around the world before the truth gets its boots on. Now, okay, Milton was talking about a free and open encounter. I'll come back to that. Perhaps he's talking about the long run. If anybody knew that the fortunes of truth could change quickly and in life or death matters, it was a Puritan in the Protestant and Catholic battles of the 17th century in England. But again, he and his liberal followers, both in our politics, such as Thomas Jefferson, and our religion, such as James Luther Adams, would argue, well, it's the best system we've got. But now we have this debate going on with the questioning of controversial speakers, say, when they appear on college campuses, sometimes the harassment and violent threats, which are sanctioned by very few people. In turn, those controversial, usually right-wing speakers say that they are the ones being bullied. Liberals, and I mean here religious liberals, although it gets quite confused with political issues in these conversations, we theological liberals who believe so strongly in freedom of speech and place so much faith in truth, we find ourselves confused because we want to support complete freedom, we want to trust in the process, we want to be, like in the political realm, the ACLU, championing the right of all to speak, communists and Nazis, bigots and their targets, trusting that truth will in time prevail and that suppression gets us nowhere. And yet, from within liberal ranks, there's dissent, an argument that some voices don't deserve to be heard, do so much harm by being heard that they cannot be justified, that their being heard itself threatens the freedom of some of the people gathered in these places of free debate. The social psychologist and explorer of morality, Jonathan Haidt, calls this safetyism. Social psychologist, as I said, and he looks out into society to see the many ways it gets repeated. For example, a style of parenting that seeks to remove all obstacles. Some even connect this safetyism to a form of government that seeks to lift the poorest and protect us from the ravages of misfortune and offer extra help to those who are disabled or aged or otherwise impeded in our ideals of the pursuit of happiness. That could be a whole other sermon series, but we're talking about speech here. We're talking about talking. So let's look at that a while. The critics from the left, one might say, of this liberal ideal, talk of the difficulty of being in the room where debate happens, when your very right to be there is questioned, when your very existence is called into doubt in the course of the debate. For example, transgender folks, of whom some feminists argue that they're simply men trying to infiltrate female space. Gay people, of whom it was said not long ago right here in our church that even hanging out a rainbow flag to show that they're welcome, quote, scares away families, as if family is an exclusively cisgender heterosexual domain. These are questions of identity and become extremely painful. Not just painful, some would argue, but threatening. In these circumstances, they ask, can we even have the free debate of which Milton and Adams dreamed, on which Adams would say our liberal religion is founded? And if we can't, what is our recourse? I was brought up short by this issue when talking some years ago to a friend about some high school student's wish to have a certain book removed from the high school curriculum. These debates rage on right and left. This was a tough one for me, as it is for a lot of political and theological liberals. The book in question was The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. The problem there is not the values expressed in the book, nor its worthiness. Huck Finn is often cited as the greatest, most important novel in the U.S. American canon. One can't consider oneself well-educated in U.S. literature without having read it, I think it's fair to say. Twain is a great writer, nobody was disputing that point, and furthermore, it is a passionately anti-racist work to which we wish kids to be exposed. We wish them to grapple, as Huck does, with the debate between conscience and one's society when one's society is in the wrong. The students who wished that it would not be read in their classes, required in their classes, were not debating about any of that. What they found excruciating was its frequent use of the N-word. And of course they're right that in normal circumstances that word does not belong in the classroom. My friend and I agreed on that completely. I was arguing that the word was part of the racist landscape of the book, necessary to its telling, and that to get Twain's powerful message of conscience over racism across, it was important not to excise the word from the book nor the book from the curriculum. My friend said, the problem was this. The N-word isn't harmful only when hurled as an insult, but also when innocently read in quotes from this book set in the 19th century and spoken in the voice of an ignorant boy for whom it was as common a word as bread or river. She said the problem for her when she was a student was that she was the only black student in the room. And every time the word was uttered, the eyes of several kids would slide to her. She was in a spotlight. The discussion became about her, and it made those classes torture for her, not for the others. The word does have that much power, even when not snarled nastily. That is, after why I'm not saying it, why I won't say it in church or ever. She has gone on, by the way, to become a literature scholar of some renown. And what this discussion pointed me to was the larger question that doesn't seem to be touched when we talk about how free should our speech be. The larger question wasn't Twain and his marvelous tale of a young man struggling to overcome his racist training against all the pressures of his society. It wasn't the word itself. The question that we really needed to engage was the impossibly unequal and hostile environment in which these students were expected to engage with one another. I've wondered ever since, what if teachers in this situation laid a groundwork first? Not only strictly forbidding students to do the turn and stare thing, but in creating a more equal classroom. What if that effort were guided by African American students and teachers and community members? Because I'm just guessing here, trying to extrapolate from my own experiences, and that's the situation that a white teacher is in. But with the guidance of the affected people, perhaps teachers could address the real problem in engaging with controversial matters affecting those people. What if truth and falsehood were not only both on the field, but we made the field level first? Because a U.S. American classroom is not a level field. Neither, I'm sorry to say, is a church. People bring their privileges and power into these spaces, and the ones who have the most privilege and the most power are usually the least aware of the slant of the field. I'm aware of the bootstrap nature of what we're asking here. How can we make the field level until it's level? How can we even have these conversations until we can have these conversations? I have no simple answer to that, but some more things to ponder. In the mid-1940s, the wonderful short story writer and novelist Flannery O'Connor wrote a story called The Barber that she never published in her short lifetime, but that has been published in her complete works because, as one reviewer says, even her B-sides were this good. In the story, a rare liberal in a fictional southern small town tries to argue with his barber and everyone else gathered in the barber shop about segregation. They're about to vote in the Democratic white primary, that's what she calls it in the second sentence in the story, and he wants to vote for the integrationist. For the time it takes to have his hair cut, he makes his case for that candidate. Even in 2013, the same reviewer interprets this as a situation where the liberal makes such a weak case that it, quote, doesn't even impress the black boy sweeping the floors. By the way, he is referred to as a boy in the story, but he must be at least of voting age, 21. Doesn't even impress that black young man sweeping the floors, but that misses the point entirely. It is true that the liberal in the story seeks to bring into the argument the young black man sweeping up at the back of the store. He says, you say that segregation is good for black people as well as white people, let's ask him. Let's ask George. George answers, but it's remarkable to notice that he does not just express his opinion. He says, I don't know, is they gonna let me vote? Do I'm gonna vote for Mr. Hoxson, the segregationist. I don't know if they're gonna let me vote. The liberal's failing is that he thinks the field is level. That's why he thinks having this argument might make things finally settle into a truer way. But George doesn't even have a voice in the election. Whether he votes depends on the segregationists allowing him to do so. Acting as if we are having an open debate when some people have so much power over others makes a mockery of the earnest battle between truth and falsehood that Milton envisaged, that we rest our faith on. Now, the case of the barber and 1940s segregation is a little unfair for me to use in this situation, I understand. George's freedom to speak was hemmed in not only by ridicule, as any of us might face by voicing an unpopular opinion. He was limited by the threat of fatal violence. That's seldom extant in the forums in which we debate, such as this very congregation, such as our wider community. But it lurks around the edges. One of those things that those with power and privilege can ignore. But in a country where transgender people, especially trans women of color, are murdered at terrifying rates, and few killers are caught or convicted, where committing the misdemeanor of crossing the border without permission can get you locked up without due process and indefinitely. There is real violence just outside this bubble of conversation where we claim to be free. Given that the field is never level, we can and must think about what kind of forum we want this one to be. Our church, the place where we congregate, where we come to be both safe and challenged. What do we do with the painful aspects of debate? Well, what would JLA do? Adams, it turns out, when he talks about freedom, talks about this very matter. First of all, of course, he talks about how all responsible liberals recognize the necessity for certain restrictions on individual freedom. For example, education may be compulsory within the liberal state, if not in the liberal church, he says. But he goes on to say, we also recognize that persuasion can be perverted into a camouflage for duress. And like Milton, he calls upon us to have open discourse. He knows that not all discourse that appears open is. Not all freedom to persuade is actual persuasion. Sometimes it is coercion. And that is what this new wave of conscience is asking us to consider. Toni Morrison says in the quote that Jane shared, the function of freedom is to free others, and the function of power is to empower others. She doesn't say so, but the parallel leads us to consider the fact that freedom is itself a kind of power, and power bestows freedom. Those of us for whom disagreement is merely uncomfortable because it hints that we are not in the unassailably correct and true position, that our power is not earned, we have an obligation to expand that freedom to those for whom disagreements are debates about their very identity, dignity, and worth, and sometimes even their right to live and live freely. We must question what even O'Connor's liberal in the barbershop did not consider. How can we make the field one where truth and falsehood may genuinely grapple, where the most powerful are challenged as profoundly as the rest, where we do not pretend that everyone is equally free to debate and decide? We lit our chalice in hopes of a community of connection. Perhaps those stronger connections, just as they are challenged and harmed by this imbalance of power, by this inequality, so are they the solution to it. Perhaps like lovers agreeing to marry, to bind themselves, to limit themselves, to enter into unfreedom in order to be more truly free, we could engage seriously with how do we want to limit ourselves in such a way as to have the true free ideal of which Adams spoke, of which he wrote in the 1940s, a time like the 1640s in which freedom was a very fragile thing indeed. Can we be a place where people are truly equally empowered, truly equal, and therefore all of us are free to debate, to determine the truth for ourselves, to decide our moral path? This is the dream toward which we work. We move toward it stepwise and sideways, backing and filling imperfectly, clumsily, but never, let us pray, hesitantly. For without it, None of us can live up to our ideals of freedom.